My name's Jim Seward. I'm an attorney. I'm also a colonel in the Kansas Army National Guard.
Going back into your background, where did you grow up?
I grew up in western South Dakota in Spearfish. I was tired of bussing tables at a local restaurant, and a new McDonald's had opened in Spearfish. I wasn't old enough to apply, but I kept applying, and eventually the owners called my parents and asked me to quit applying. And through persistence and ignoring other folks, I kept applying. And before I was 16, before they could legally hire me to work in the kitchen, they finally called and gave me a job. And I started off in corporate America.
What was your experience like in your first stint in corporate America?
It was fascinating. Of course, I was a high school kid and we were wearing polyester uniforms, which our friends made fun of. But they had extensive books that you could study and learn leadership, learn about the business, learn about the equipment. And I quickly moved into a trainer role and then shortly thereafter a manager role. And didn't think I needed college. At 18, I knew two things. I was never going to college, and I was never going in the military.
How did you make the move from, I'm never going to do these things, to...
The military came first in the fall after my senior year when all of my friends moved away and I was managing people that were flipping burgers. I drove to Rapid City and talked to a recruiter who was able to do the paperwork to put me in an M1 tank in Europe. And I thought that sounded fascinating, so I joined the Army.
How did you cross the gap from I'm never going to do this to I'm driving to a recruiter?
Well, I was 18, so my frontal lobe wasn't very well developed, and I had a friend who wanted to join the Army with me. And so we believed what we were told, and we joined what they called at the time, 33 years ago, a cohort program where we would be stationed together in Europe.
Given the tone you're saying that with, I'm guessing it didn't play out exactly the way they'd expect.
I think it may have, except 3 weeks into basic training, my friend decided he didn't like the Army and did something to get himself removed from basic training.
What was it then that caused you not to do the thing to get yourself kicked out?
I think I've always enjoyed the camaraderie and the leadership opportunities and the leadership training.
When you think about leadership from a military perspective, what kinds of thoughts pop to mind for you?
When I was a young leader, when I attained the rank of sergeant, I really started to learn new things about what I thought was leadership. When I was at McDonald's, I was really a manager, not a leader. And the military teaches you from the very beginning that part of leadership is caring for the people that are on your team. And while your job might be defined as inspiring and influencing others to achieve their goals, what you really need to figure out is who your folks are. And if you've got young soldiers or young bankers or young attorneys on your team, are they married? Are they in a relationship? Do they have kids? When's their birthday? What do they like to do? What keeps them awake at night? And we all have those issues that we have to deal with outside of work. Maybe it's maybe mom's got cancer, or maybe mom died when you were a young child. The Army taught me at an early age to really engage with those individuals and get to know them. And that was much different than managing a team.
That difference between managing and leading, are there any other distinctions you draw between those two?
I think strategy plays a greater role in leadership than it does in managing.
The idea of strategic thinking, it's a great buzzword. Thousands more books
written
about that.
Right.
If you had to do an armchair definition of what it is to have a strategy or to define the word strategy, what words pop to mind?
I'm lucky that I get to do a lot of training in the world of strategy. I've worked with dozens of nonprofits, been on the boards of dozens of nonprofits over my career and in many different businesses, whether that was my other career when I was general counsel to the governor of South Dakota and led a large team there and worked at the strategic level. What I find is that it's easiest to boil it down to four things. What is the current state that we're dealing with? What's going on in the environment? What do we want the desired end state to look like? What problems or obstacles lie in the way? And then what actions could we take that would address the problems? And what I find with many folks who either haven't studied strategy or haven't spent significant time working in the strategic realm, most people start with number four. They think, what action can we take to address this problem? And I think we see that a lot when, you know, we all work, whether it's at our local church or with a nonprofit that we're involved with. Maybe you've got a management type individual who's moved into a leadership position in that realm, and you're sitting at the local chamber meeting and there's a problem. And the discussion usually starts with, what action can we take to address that problem? And because of my position in Kansas as the state judge advocate and as a colonel, I've been blessed with the opportunity to attend the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And once I eventually graduate from that program, I'll have a master's in strategic studies. And if you would have asked me 10 years ago to try to talk about strategy, I probably would have started with you on number four. But if we really slow down and think about what's going on in the environment and where do we want to go, what do we want it to look like, and we break that out into those four steps, the War College calls it design for the strategist, those four steps. And so I didn't invent this, but it's something I learned and I get to pass on. And for me, that's one of the things I love about leadership. I was telling you a story before we started that last weekend on Saturday, as many folks in Wyoming get to do, we got to enjoy a day in the great outdoors. And we said we were hiking Medicine Bow Peak. I have taken that word hike to task with my wife because I really felt like when it was over, it was more like a journey or a trek or something other than a hike. That 7+ miles round trip, and when you first begin from Marie Lake, you start off on this journey up a very steep incline, and it's not long and you're on loose rock. And you're on a trail, but you're on very loose rock and you're gaining a lot of elevation. And even if you live in Cheyenne or somewhere else in Wyoming at a high elevation, suddenly you're at 10,000 feet. And unless you're a young soldier or athlete, you're feeling the exertion. We made it to the summit and we were coming down, and it really struck me as I met different groups of people coming down. Some wanted to talk. Some I could see for hundreds of yards before we reached them, and they were struggling. Maybe there were three in the party, and there was one clearly struggling, and the two that weren't struggling wanted to get to the top, but they didn't want to leave this individual. And depending where we were on the journey, I would occasionally tell them what was ahead. Maybe the terrain was going to flatten out 300 yards ahead, but they couldn't see that. A couple times I shared that kind of information with the folks coming up the hill, and one of them said, "Thanks for the inspiration." And it reminded me, Sam Walton had a famous quote that said, "Inspirational leaders, outstanding leaders, go out of their way to boost the self-esteem of their personnel. If people believe in themselves, it's amazing what they can accomplish." I think back through my career, the times when I failed as a leader, when I was maybe focused on a goal and not focused on my team, how I failed to inspire, failed to make people believe in themselves. And then other times when I could see that I had really engaged with a team and they knew I cared about them. And no matter what, they knew I had their back and we were going to achieve that goal. And the amazing thing about leadership that I think a lot of people that haven't been there don't realize is how much work it is. But it's just as much work to be on the team. It's usually a different kind of work. The leader might not always be the one carrying the load, but carrying that team can be a tremendous burden as well.
Stepping back into your military experience, you've crossed off one of the things you said you would never do. The second one, in terms of going back to college, you've obviously done because you're an attorney and you're a member of the JAG Corps. What was it that caused you to give up on the second thing you weren't going to do, go back to school and go back to law school?
I credit it to a great leader. For the young folks listening, there used to be a border between East and West Germany. and I'm old enough to have been a Border Patrol soldier, and we were walking the border many times, and we'd have discussions. Ronald Reagan was president. He was telling Mikhail Gorbachev, the leader of the Soviet Union, to tear down the wall. I would argue with my lieutenants who had been to college about global politics and policy and things like that. And my sergeant would tell me all the time that I needed to get out and go to college. And he pressed me to eventually take a college course while I was over there. And he took it with me. And I got an A. And he convinced me to take another one. And I got another A. And that gave me the confidence, I think, that I had lacked. I hadn't been much of a high school student. I had worked very hard at work and not very well or hard at high school. And I got out of the Army after about 4 years and went to the University of South Dakota, stayed there, and went to law school.
Through your career in law, you've also gone in a variety of different directions with that in terms of advising folks who are making policies that affect all of us. Does having that background or that thought process, does it bring something different, do you feel?
Pursuing and accomplishing a law degree is another journey that is unlike anything I've ever done before. The type of education that they give you in law school is 180 degrees different than an undergraduate education. The amount of dedication, the Socratic method of teaching, where you're being asked questions and held accountable for your answers, that analytical reasoning that you go through to get through law school, to pass the bar exam, it's much different than anything I did in undergrad. And for folks that really want a challenge and really want to learn a different way of thinking, I would urge them to consider that.
You still practice in a variety of different ways. What do you draw from it today?
I look back on my time on the border. I used to see those folks in East Germany, and it just seemed unjust to me the way they were treated. And I've tried to carry that through, whether it's work in criminal justice reform, which I did while I was with the governor of South Dakota, to reform the adult, juvenile, and mental health, three different systems we reformed in South Dakota. I still work in that arena now through a think tank in Washington, D.C. I think that's what drives me to keep practicing law.
If you've learned one or two things about leadership that we haven't talked about yet.
I certainly, somewhere in the last 10 years, learned about the engagement. That if you're really going to build trust with your team, which I think is one of the key pillars of leadership, you have to be an engaging leader. And that can tie to the caring, but you can care and not be engaged. You've worked with and you've seen leaders that maybe they lead a team of 300 people in four different offices, and they report to a board. You can bet that 99% of them are engaged when they're with the board. They're not always engaged when they're talking to the custodian in one of the outer offices, who maybe they'll learn whose husband was just diagnosed with cancer, and the medical treatment plan that the company has appears to have a gap, and she's getting the runaround, or he's getting the runaround. And engaged leaders learn that kind of information. They don't always have to fix it. Sometimes they just have to listen. Sometimes they delegate. Sometimes they visit with HR. Sometimes they fix it. But the fact that they're engaged inspires that employee, builds their self-esteem, makes their work experience and life better. I always tell my folks, I want you to love coming to work. Most of us have to do this. Most of us don't get to choose whether or not we're going to go to work on Monday. And you get to spend more time with your coworkers usually than most of your family. And so you should enjoy that. It doesn't matter if you're at McDonald's and you're helping feed a community. Maybe that community is like the community in Cheyenne, where they're feeding airmen and airwomen that are running an Air Force base and working with NORTHCOM out of Colorado Springs to ensure the national homeland defense of our nation. We all have important roles to play, and engaged leaders, I believe, make sure that their team members know. And I think that's one of the big things I picked up in the last segment of my life.
Is there anything you're thinking about or you find yourself chewing on these days?
I think I'm always chewing on something. Life is oftentimes a humbling experience, and maybe it's always a humbling experience, and we never know when that humbling opportunity to learn is going to meet us and challenge us. And I think the COVID epidemic has challenged millions and millions of people in our country, from our national and state leaders to our local leaders to our waiters and waitresses. Our nation has been humbled by this experience. And without getting into a long hour and a half discussion on national security, I've been chewing a lot about the national security aspect of this. I'll give you one tidbit from War College here. There's the traditional warfare that we're all accustomed to seeing books on and or seeing movies and reading books, whether it's World War I, World War II, the Civil War, that traditional kind of warfare. There's another warfare that is prevalent in today's world called hybrid warfare, where there are attacks that attack our cyber infrastructure and attack nations from within. And I'm not suggesting that this is happening to us and that COVID is part of that. I'm not suggesting that big conspiracy, but I've been chewing a lot on the concept of what are the other nations in the world thinking and planning and doing. We know that we have, I won't call them enemies, I'll call them competitors. We know that China and Russia and North Korea and Iran are competitors. They want to be world leaders. We are the lone superpower today. So when you ask me what I've been chewing on, it's kind of a weighty subject, but it has to do with leadership. And that concept of what's going on in our nation internally flows over to the work that we're doing in the think tank right now about what's going on in our cities across America. Fortunately, most of our folks don't have to spend their days thinking about those concepts. One guy asked me one time why everybody doesn't vote. And I said, because they're busy raising their families and paying taxes. You know, they're taking care of each other. I think that goes along the same lines as what leaders across our country are thinking about today.
Given how much you've thought about that and are literally studying these issues, if you had to pick one reason to be optimistic about where we are and where we're going.
I think America is an amazing, amazing place. In fact, I put an article on LinkedIn where the main competitor of Vladimir Putin was just poisoned for the third or fourth time, and he's unconscious. The reason I shared that is because I'm so proud to be an American. And I'm so thankful that we can argue and disagree and protest, but in the end, we're a civil people, generally. And we have survived this experiment for hundreds of years now, and I believe and I'm hopeful that we're going to survive whatever challenges lie ahead. And we will look back on this time as a time that we learned a great deal about ourselves and the rest of the world.
You brought a quote with you, and it's a long enough quote that you brought it so that you get it accurate.
The quote's by Calvin Coolidge, who was president. He made Custer State Park his summer White House. Years ago, I ran across this quote. I'll read it. Nothing in this world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. I look back in my life and the time that I found this quote, what I was struggling through, and how many times during that struggle I wanted to quit. And doesn't matter if you're climbing Medicine Bow Peak or trying to get that college degree, trying to pay off your house or make your rent payment. It doesn't matter where you are in life. If you don't quit, if you just persist, it's unbelievable how many times I've been in the middle of that steep incline and taken 20 more steps and found that things flatten out and I get a little bit of reprieve and I get to live to fight another day.
It's a great quote and a great philosophy. I know we may not get to keep you in Wyoming forever because you have so many interests. Thanks for what you're doing behind the scenes here in Wyoming and for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to visit with you today.